For the week of February 15th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 269, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Hey, Sperling.
How are you, Michael?
Excuse me. Sir. You're supposed to call me Sir.
Sir, I don't understand what this is referring to at all. You know, I wonder if our audience thinks that we planned this. I have no idea what you're referring to.
You're supposed to keep your eyes averted. You call me Sir. And when I ask you to, you go to the Red Room of Pain and wait for me there.
Okay. Now I get what you're talking
about.
And
bondage and discipline goes mainstream.
Yes. American Sniper is what we're referring to, right?
That's right. So when we get to American Sniper and, of course, 50 Shades of Grey, what else will we be covering in the show?
Well, on this week's show, we'll tell you how when journalists aren't reporting the news, they can wind up making it. A number of journalists have been in the headlines this past week, topped by the six-month suspension of NBC News anchor Brian Williams for discrepancies in his, well, I guess, storytelling. This news was nearly overshadowed by a fake news anchor, Jon Stewart, announcing he would step down from The Daily Show after 17 years.
It practically was overshadowed. I wouldn't even say nearly.
I knew when I wrote that sentence, I said, you know what? I guarantee you Michael will interrupt me right here because he's going to say it wasn't nearly overshadowed. It was overshadowed.
It was bigger news.
Yes, it was.
Bizarrely, that's the world we live in.
And what happens if you're a big Hollywood studio, Michael, and you try to reboot a cash cow of a franchise like, say, I don't know, Spider-Man, and it doesn't work? Well, duh, you try and reboot the reboot. Everyone knows that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And it begins and ends not with just one movie. A couple movies did great, but the biggest movie around the world, of course, is 50 Shades of Grey. It made $240 million worldwide on its opening weekend. For a movie that cost $40 million to make, that's awfully good.
Yeah.
And domestically on Monday, it made more money because that was a holiday here in North America. So it's now at $252 million worldwide. Essentially, they opened it up in every country that celebrates Valentine's Day.
Yes, that, although there are some countries it will not play in, like the United Arab Emirates.
Well, duh, of course. There's some countries most movies don't play in.
Russia's North Caucasus as well.
Well, there you go. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
We'll finish up with 50 Shades of Grey, but first the other movies. That wasn't the only story here. Kingsman, The Secret Service, also did very well in its opening weekend. It grossed $58 million. It's now at $80 million worldwide. This is sort of the teen James Bond from the director of Kick-Ass, and it's a more adult film than calling something a teen James Bond might suggest. It got better reviews than 50 Shades of Grey, better audience scores. We'll have to see if it ends up having better legs. And both of them, of course, will almost certainly have sequels. At number three around the world is SpongeBob SquarePants, the sequel, another $45 million. It's at $140 million worldwide, and it's starting to open up overseas. At number four, our first film from overseas, Somewhere Only We Know. This is a Chinese drama. It grossed $30 million, and it's now at $43 million and counting. I think it opened up in the middle of the week. This is a Chinese drama. Where are my notes? There they are. It's about a young woman heartbroken over the death of her grandmother and being dumped by her fiance. I hate when that happens at the same time. She heads to Prague to research the life her grandmother spent there for a few years and realizes her grandmother had a lover when she was in Prague and tries to track him down. The movie flashes back to all the way to 1970.
Wow.
Isn't that depressing? It's very depressing when movies flash back all the way to a year when you were still alive. That's when you know you're getting old. Oh, my God. Flashback to 1982. You know, like Hot Tub Time Machine. Good God. Anyway, that's off to an excellent start. At number five is Jupiter Ascending. Another $25 million, but it's falling fast. It's at $91 million worldwide. Channing Tatum wants you all to just forget about it and watch the hilarious trailer to Magic Mike XXL. I saw it opening up for 50 Shades of Grey. It's online. It's actually it's funnier than the entire first film. That's all I can say.
First film meant to be funny?
Well, there was a lot of humor in it. It was supposed to be sexy, fun, silly, you know. It was a lark. You know, there was drama in it, but there was certainly humor. This trailer is very funny, though, very knowing. And number six is American Sniper, still rolling along strongly. Another $20 million. It's about to pass the $400 million mark. I think it's now officially Clint Eastwood's biggest hit as a director or actor in his career. not adjusted for inflation.
Wow. That's, I mean, did you see that coming? I don't think anybody saw that coming.
What was the Gran Torino? That's the one I didn't see coming. Why that was such a massive hit? This at least is based on a best-selling memoir. It's in his wheelhouse. It has a hot actor. Gran Torino, he stands and grumbles at kids, you know, on his lawn. Why that movie made so much money, I have no idea. This one, it's not a surprise to me. I mean, it's certainly a phenomenally successful, but there's lots of reasons you can point to why it would do well.
I've got a really hip car. Get off my lawn.
Moving all the way down, Big Hero 6, Taken 3, Imitation Game, Night at the Museum. They're all making money. None of them have really rewritten the word on their success at this stage. But at number 11 is Detective K, Secret of the Lost Island. This is a South Korean drama. It's a sequel to the first Detective K film, which itself is based on a series of novels. I don't know if there's more than two, but there are at least two. And this one is, I think it's set in the late 1700s. And this one is about a counterfeiting ring that Detective K must break up. But it's doing very well on its opening weekend, $6 million. Not a huge amount for South Korea. We know they can do more, but it's off to a solid start. And Seventh Son, Paddington, Theory of Everything. Is there anything else to say? The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. This is probably going to fade out and will not get to $1 billion, in part due to currency issues. The other currencies are weak overseas, so the money that comes back to North America isn't worth as much in dollar terms. This film would have passed $1 billion if it had been back when the last one was released and other currencies were stronger. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does, although I don't know why everything has to be measured in dollars. I guess it is the world's reserve currency for the most part. But
it's the currency the studios deal in.
Yeah, so. but in Argentina, for instance, they don't take the money out in Brazil.
Because they can't. Because the currency is so weak right now.
Yes.
So it just, you know, it depends. That's the box office.
You don't want to talk about Papa or Mama.
We did talk about it before. That's at $10 million now and counting. Birdman is down there. It's at $72 million worldwide. That's a big success story for a movie like that, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know what the budget was on Birdman. Do you?
I don't, no. But it wasn't much.
It wasn't a big expensive movie. Michael Keaton probably did it for scale.
Oh, I don't know about that. Just because it was filmed in a theater doesn't mean he was doing it for actors' equity wages.
Fair enough, but it's certainly going to rebound to him and give him a whole new life in his career. But that brings us back, of course, to 50 Shades of Grey. What can't we say about this movie?
What can't we say about it?
Yeah, there's nothing. There's just endless amounts of things to discuss. It's the biggest film with flogging in history of cinema. The first one was, of course, The Passion of the Christ.
So
that also has flogging. But 50 Shades of Grey beat the opening weekend for Passion of the Christ, which did have the February record. It will ultimately pass The Passion of the Christ. I shouldn't actually say that. Passion of the Christ made so much money, but it may perhaps beat that overall in final grosses, but we'll have to see what its legs are like.
Oh, because you're looking at its legs. I see what you're doing there. You're looking at legs because it's a movie about, you know, BDSM.
I mean, Passion of the Christ made $622 million worldwide. It looks like this film, if it has any multiple at all, should pass that. But domestically, The Passion of the Christ made $370 million. This movie is at what? What is it making North America?
$95 million so far.
Yeah, I don't see it passing that, really. I mean, I think it's a front-loaded movie. I'm sure it will fall hard and fast.
I would agree.
When you start with $250 million, who cares?
Yeah.
When it costs $40 million to make, it can fall hard and fast, and you'll be just fine.
By the way, Birdman cost $18 million to make.
$18 million, and it's at $72 million worldwide. So that's like a five multiple. So it's made five times its budget.
Oh, it's done quite well for itself.
Yeah, you're doing just great. What else did 50 Shades Grey do? What else did it do? What other records did it set?
I don't know about records, but I'll tell you, it has more, you know, merchandising tie-ins than...
No, that's mostly tied into the book. It actually doesn't. Yeah, most of those were already in place long before the movie came out and, in fact, have no official link to the film. Most of the products you see have been on the shelves for quite a while. The book sold 100 million copies around the world. People wanted to buy 50 Shades of Grey lubricant and 50 Shades of Grey naughtiness and 50 Shades of Grey mask, but those are not related to the movie technically.
Well, there are in Scotland, I guess there was.
And the studio is not profiting from it. So that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in certain venues, extra police were brought in because they and searched women's handbags because I guess there was a problem with women bringing in wine, and they were kind of like doing like a whole little wine date with their women friends.
That's ridiculous.
I'm not making it up.
I'm sure it happened somewhere, but to report on that, who cares? You know, like as if there was, oh my God, they're bringing in wine. It was not a worldwide epidemic of wine drinking at 50 Shades of Grey. Some theater, you know, theaters search bags regularly. Here in Manhattan, if you go to the Empire Theater, they always search your bags because they don't want you to bring in outside food and drink. Got nothing to do with the movie.
Ah, okay.
And there were big audiences, so you'd have to double check and see, is this the policy of the theater always? Because no theater wants you to bring in outside food and stuff, but they don't always check your bags. Some check just in prime time in the evening. Others check all the time when you walk into a theater in Manhattan. I don't know what it's like in L.A., but there are some theaters who try to be more aggressive about that because it discourages people from bringing in, you know, make you throw out your water bottle, your food, whatever. Like you can't bring it in.
It's worse than going through the airport.
Well, it is sometimes. They understandably, because their concession sales seem to be falling, right? Well, again, it set a Valentine's weekend record. It set a near record for an R-rated film.
And for a female director, I think you already mentioned that.
I did not, but it did. It was the highest grossing opener for a female director who is not returning to the sequel. Is that true?
Well, I guess she had a bit of some conflict with E.L. James, the author, who, you know, never having made a movie before, had way too much say in the making of...
Way too much say? The movie just grossed $250 million. If she got her way, maybe she had exactly the right amount of say.
Yeah,
if you're talking about box office, why did she have too much say? She knew the books. J.K. Rowling was consulted regularly on Harry Potter. You know, they had no horror stories of dealing with her. But, you know, when you've got an author and you've got a franchise that people feel strongly about, it's smart to bring the writer in on your team and make them feel part of the collaboration. Did they butt heads? Yes. Did the final film make tons of money? Yes. Could they make nice and maybe she could come back and do the second? Maybe it's not worth her bother. Or maybe the second and third books aren't as interesting.
I don't know.
I haven't read them. You know, I know there's a stalker who's even in the first book. You know, it's a former lover of Christian Grey who shows up to stalk our heroine. So maybe there'll be more drama in the second and third one. But, you know, I don't know. You can immediately, she had too much power. Well, it worked out right, at least commercially, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, years from now, what will be remembered is the opening of the film and whether it made any money and the phenomena around it.
Well, it made tons of money.
Right.
It only cost $40 million to make. Men made up 32% of the audience only on Saturday. That was the peak men. It was Valentine's Day here in North America and, of course, around the world, apparently, in 50-plus countries. Why aren't more men going to this movie? I take my girlfriend to this movie. Are they nuts? Why wouldn't you take your wife and your girlfriend to this movie?
At the same time.
Yes, of course. that's nicely done. But no, seriously, I don't understand why guys do not want to take chicks to see Magic Mike XXL and 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, where is their head at? I don't understand. It's for chicks. You're an idiot if you don't want to take your girlfriend or wife to 50 Shades of Grey.
They don't call it a chick flick for nothing.
Well, but I don't understand it. It's not a chick flick like Beaches. It's a chick flick that's sexy.
Okay, well, I don't know.
Well, here's my favorite little bit of info. I mean, I don't think there's anything else to say about 50 Shades of Grey. It made tons of money. It did really well. But I love this little detail. In North America, it got an R rating.
Yes.
In the UK, it got an adult rating, which is equivalent to NC-17. And you can see some countries 16, some countries adult, some countries, you know, it varies, of course, from country to country and culture to culture. France. What did France rate 50 Shades of Grey? They gave it a 12 rating. Anyone over 12 can go see 50 Shades. They're like, well, of course, it's just a little spanky spanky.
We don't see what the problem is.
Exactly. They're like, we don't care about sex. It's perfectly normal. what could be more cliched and beautiful than that? One thing we know is that 50 Shades of Grey will not be part of the conversation towards time in 2016.
No, that's true. Although, you know, you said your favorite was the French thing. My favorite is that at B&Q, I guess that's a hardware store in the UK, the staff will be provided with copies of 50 Shades of Grey so that they can prepare for all of the increased demand for, like, robes and duct tape and all that BDSM gear that people are going to be storming into the hardware store for.
Well, good for them to get PR out on about that and get their store's name mentioned in the paper, because that's just silly. Why would you need to give your staff a copy of 50 Shades of Grey?
Because
what
otherwise,
would you do when somebody asks for cable ties? You smile and giggle and say, here they are. You know, it's like, it's not, you don't need to read the book to help someone find out where the cable ties are. That's just silly, and it got them attention, and more power to them.
Well, awards get movies and television shows attention. And
that's true.
You were about to mention that the WGA Awards were held this past weekend. And the
Who won?
The Imitation Game and the Grand Budapest Hotel, which I guess the Grand Budapest Hotel was expected to win for Wes Anderson.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's an adaptation and original. Is Grand Budapest adapted or original? I forget now.
I believe it was adapted, no?
Well, it's inspired by the works of Stefan Zweig, but I'm not sure if its location is in the Oscars. I think that might have even been a point of issue for one or two movies. I know Whiplash was an issue.
Well, actually, it was the original screenplay. Grand Budapest Hotel won for original screenplay.
Original, okay.
And The Imitation Game was an adapted screenplay.
Now, that's funny, because I don't know what it's adapted from. It wasn't adapted from the
book. Alan Turing, The Enigma by Andrew Hodges.
Okay, that's not the one I know. I know a better one. And it's not adapted from the play, obviously, Breaking the Code, since it's radically different from that.
Okay. Huh.
So, yeah, there's been many books about Alan Turing. That is, the Hodges one is not the one I know of as the best, but there you go.
Well, it's the one they made into a
movie. Hugely successful film. What about television? Were there any TV awards?
I think there were, actually. What was it, True Detective and Louie won?
Well, there you go. So that's best drama and best comedy. Louis, I have never really watched.
It's funny. I've seen like maybe four or five episodes, and it was incredibly funny.
Why have you only watched four or five if it was incredibly funny?
Because there are only so many hours in the day.
Well, yes. Budapest Hotel is up for best original screenplay for the Oscars, along with Birdman, Boyhood, Foxcatcher, and Nightcrawler, which I did just see and liked a lot. I thought that was a very good movie.
I think that the Budapest Hotel cannot lose this just because it's like the only thing they can give it. They could give it Best Picture, but
they most certainly could.
I think that most people will just say, oh, we'll give that, but you know, there you go, Wes. Here's an Oscar.
I really don't think they think that way.
We'll see.
That's the way we interpret the awards. They don't say, well, we got it. They love it and they want to give it an award. And that's what they just think it's, most deserving for compared to the other nominees.
Okay.
You know, I would love it if, he wasn't even, Ray Fiennes wasn't even nominated for Best Actor. It's a shame that actually Jake Gyllenhaal wasn't nominated. I found the nominees this year to be very boring in the acting categories. They seem very knee-jerk and uninteresting. But there you go. But those aren't the only awards, right? What else happened?
Well, I think there was
makeup and other things and cinematography, which is one of my favorites.
Yeah, and I guess Emmanuel Lubezki won for Birdman. This is a film that really does not seem to be able to lose.
I wish it would go away. And in fact, the cinematography was dreadful on the film. Dreadful. It was one long stunt of a faux tracking shot for the entire movie. You know, you're following characters throughout the entire film. It doesn't stay with Michael Keaton, so it's a godlike perspective, so it makes no sense. It's not like you're following one person for the whole film, a la, say, the Dardenne brothers. And where the Dardenne brothers stay on top of a character and create a sense of immediacy and excitement and intimacy, in this film, it calls attention to itself every 2 seconds. You're never not aware of what the camera is doing and what a stunt it is. And
Although, to me, it's dreadful.
It's absolutely dreadful. It ruins the movie, which is not a good movie in the first place. But it's actually the worst element in the film. And to single that out as award-worthy is stupid. And it's just, oh, look, it's a long tracking shot, even though it's not, of course, because they cut as they must. Or they don't have to, but they did, just like Rope. There are moments where you can see where they paused and, you know, pulled into a new, you know, it's dark for a moment or whatever. They're going through a doorway, and that gives them a chance to set up a new shot. They didn't do the whole movie in one take, a la Russian Ark. You know?
Right.
So to me, it was just, it's nonsense. It is a terribly, terribly shot film.
Although most laymen I know, and those are people not working in the industry, they're just going to see the film. When I tell them, hey, did you notice that the film was shot with one shot, one take.
Well, it wasn't done in one shot and one take.
But they had no idea. They said, oh, I guess I never noticed that. It was just the camera floating. Yeah, no, I didn't pick up on that.
Well, then they're pretty dumb people, because you have even casual movie fans will talk about the big tracking shot in Goodfellas, or the tracking shot in this or that, or the big shot in Atonement. People notice that stuff. That's not exactly minor cineast stuff. You really have to be out to lunch if you don't notice that this movie is one big, long, swooping camera movement. You know, you're really not paying attention. So I think you just need new friends.
Maybe. But, Emmanuel Lubezki, who won for Best Cinematography of a Feature Film, he won that same award last year for Gravity, went on to win the Academy Award.
That's right. Well, of course, everybody picks the final awards. The cinematographers do the nominees, and the cinematographers chose who won Birdman for the ASC Award. But it's the whole Academy, actors, directors, and others. But the actors and everybody loves this film, so it's certainly creating a little excitement when it looked like Boyhood was just going to tromp its way to the Oscars. Before, it looked inevitable to win picture and director. Now, I think its best shot is director, and if it wins picture, it'll seem like a surprise.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think when you look at, it's won the DGA, the SAG, the PGA, the Cinema Audio Society, Art Director, it's won everything. So if it
hasn't won everything.
Well, okay, but you know what I mean? It's kind of cleaning up, so to speak. And so if it doesn't win.
Who would you vote for out of those 8 films? American Sniper, Birdman, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. And don't tell me you haven't seen them all, because it doesn't matter, because most of the Oscar voters don't see them all either.
I loved Whiplash. I loved Grand Budapest Hotel. I'd probably go for Boyhood.
All right.
Just because it won't. And yes, I agree with all of those people who say, well, but the story was kind of, kind of weak. Yes, maybe. But it's never going to be done again, at least not that way. And so it was an achievement. And if you're trying to award cinematic achievement, guess what? Richard Linklater and that film pull it off.
Well, I think your thinking is akin to many Academy voters, and I won't be surprised if it actually ends up winning it all anyway.
Wow.
But I am surprised by what happened in television, which was everything.
Yes, so much happened in television. It's almost as if movies never existed.
Movies have certainly been supplanted by television in terms of creativity, and now television is supplanting the news, because that's where all the big stories are coming.
Right. I don't even know where to start. I guess we'll start with, you said that Jon Stewart kind of upstaged Brian Williams, although I'm sure Brian Williams was more than happy to give up the stage, since effectively Brian Williams, the anchor for NBC News and the evening news.
Oh, so you are starting with Brian Williams. Okay. Well, you tricked me.
Okay. So let's start
with
Jon
Stewart. No. It's fine.
Okay. Well, he's the true anchor, the true journalist, who was suspended for 6 months without pay by his superiors there at NBC Universal for, I don't even know what, like, kind of the discrepancies.
He was suspended for 6 months because of a growing scandal. Not an immediate attention, not because of what he did or didn't do, because if you're going to suspend someone, you wait until you finish your investigation. You know, so they just said, they didn't say get off the air for a few days while we look at, they just said, go. We want to make this story go away. They jumped the gun, as far as I'm concerned. You had some defense for him, and as far as stories of the other people involved. And Rolling Stone, we have a link in our show notes.
And I was wrong, by the way. You were right. He was, if you listen to last week's show, I said that Brian Williams was in a helicopter following very closely the helicopter that was shot down. You were right. It was an hour behind.
No, I was not.
Oh.
No, actually, Rolling Stone, actually, if you just watched the American media, absolutely I was right, because that's what everybody was repeating. But Rolling Stone decided to interview more than just the one guy who spoke up and said, he popped up an hour later. And they spoke to multiple people on the helicopter Brian Williams was on, media people and military people. They spoke to other people on the ground. They spoke to people. And in fact, his story has been very consistent through the years. What happens is, when you're talking about a convoy of helicopters, they all go formation typically. And ultimately, when you say we took fire, you mean the convoy, because they're 50 feet in front of you. They're not that close, but you know what I mean? They're all in formation. They're close. And when you say we took fire, you don't always mean your particular helicopter, but the group, the convoy. And in fact, soldiers on his helicopter said, we had bullets flying. It was very scary. We were under fire. They did go down. I have not heard a definitive statement yet on exactly when they all took off and when they landed. That can come out from the military, though they'll probably say it's all classified information. But Rolling Stone looked at what he'd actually said over the years,
said,
yeah, sometimes in one sentence on Letterman, he's saying we and meaning himself. And then the next sentence, he might mean we and mean the convoy. But he's been pretty consistent over the years about what he said. And it's really just the copy on the one newscast very recently that conflated them. And that was a mistake. And that should not have happened. But over the years, he hasn't conflated it. And according to some soldiers, you know, this is like the fog of war. They were under fire, and you ask people what happened, you get four different answers. But speaking to multiple people and multiple soldiers who were there, no, in fact, he hasn't conflated the story over the years. They were part of the convoy. They were not an hour behind. That's not how you travel in convoy. And that convoy did get under fire, and it was scary. And the guy described how you're inside the helicopter. You can't see what's going on. You have no visibility, you know. And so you don't know what's going on, even though you're sitting in the back because you're not the pilot. And you don't have visual on what's happening because they have armor up, so you don't get killed. And so you gland, you go, what happened? And that's part, you know, not because you were an hour behind, but because you can't see. And, you know, when you're just traveling in it, you don't have even the conversations of people are very confusing, even if you're involved and can see what's happening.
What I think is interesting is that we kind of had this back and forth last week, right? About was.
Well, I just was repeating what I read in the media. Everybody said, no, he was an hour behind. Well, they're quoting one guy.
Well, the media is doing the same thing. The media, which is faulting Brian Williams for being dishonest, is doing the same thing because later in the week, they started repeating that same, he wasn't even in that convoy. Well, he was. Apparently, as you're pointing out here, which is what I heard initially, which is what when you go back and look at the original reports, he stated. So
people have gone on the record, multiple people in the military, contradicting what the other guy said, not saying he's a liar, but just like, that's not what happened. That's not what I saw. And the one guy who's contradicting Brian Williams gets a lot more attention than the four other guys who said, no, he's pretty accurately describing what happened to us. And here's why it's confusing. And here's why what happened. But that doesn't get the play. So Rolling Stone did a very good defense of him, not saying they didn't even nail down the final details because they can't without cooperation from the military. But it does feel like a rush to judgment. A mistake was absolutely made in that final report that was on NBC News. But he hasn't been exaggerating the story step by step over the years. Not when you go back and look at the actual tapes of his appearances on Letterman and elsewhere. They characterized one time he told the story as being completely accurate and another time as essentially accurate, unless you're going to nitpick and take one sentence out and say, it doesn't include him. Well, it includes the convoy, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it feels very ugly. It feels like a typical rush to judgment. They don't seem to have any interest in even bringing him back in a way. The news is like, well, is his replacement going to replace him for good? And, you know, he seems to be out the door, kind of. So hopefully someday Brian Williams will be back on the air if he deserves and if that's what the full investigation finds out. Unfortunately, someone who won't be back on the air is Bob Simon of 60 Minutes. He died in a very difficult, sad car crash.
Yeah, and I guess it was, in a taxi? And he'd been on 60 Minutes for, 20 years?
Yeah, quite a while. And sadly, you know, he's reported all over the world in hot spots and war zones, and he dies in New York City in a car
taxi.
Crash.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's the irony of the world, isn't it? But, you know, a well-respected journalist gone after all these years.
David Carr, also a well-respected journalist and media columnist for The New York Times, died at his desk, so to speak, in the newsroom. He collapsed, and it turns out he had lung cancer, actually.
That's not what killed him, though, right? It was a heart attack or something.
Probably,
wasn't it?
Well, yeah, brought on complications from lung cancer. Yes, exactly.
Does lung cancer cause heart problems?
I don't know. I think when you have cancer,
it's not good. Yes.
The irony there is that I actually saw him the day before on I think it was the CBS Morning News, and he was talking about the Brian Williams suspension, and I looked at it and thought, wow, he really looks David Carr looks very thin. What's going on there?
Yeah, the final images I saw of him. He did look not well, but I don't know whether he didn't know he had lung cancer. Is that what you're saying?
I have no idea. I mean, and the family.
But wasn't it revealed in the autopsy though? I thought it was a surprise. But who knows? He did not look well. But you said that he's a media critic and a commentator and a thinker, and you said he had a really great course online. Can people access that?
Yes, it's at Medium. It's Press Play was the name of the course, and it really was a course for journalism students in how content distribution is shifting and how it's changing and how the entire newsroom will have to do the same and journalists will have to do the same thing and how to work with one another in the modern the modern age of media.
And it's worth checking out. You should put a link in the show notes. It's not there yet, but it will be hopefully before people come to check it out online.
It most certainly will be.
Well, one place that needs to change its shifting media is Comedy Central.
Oh, I felt when I heard this, I immediately said, thank goodness I'm not the head of Comedy Central. Could you just imagine that person right now just going, oh, no. First, you have what? John Oliver. He leaves. And it doesn't seem like a big deal because, OK, he filled in for John Stewart. He really had no place to go.
Because Colbert was ensconced in the show after Stewart.
Yeah. Right. And so, OK, Mr. Oliver, it's sorry to see you go. Good luck to you. Oh, you're going HBO. OK, great.
Then David Letterman left.
He left CBS.
That's right. He announced his retirement.
Right. Late night with David Letterman. So who takes over? Stephen Colbert, leaving the Colbert Report at the end of last year. So the follow-up to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, which he has hosted for 17 years, Jon Stewart.
17? Yeah, yes. No. Jon Stewart has, yeah.
Yes. The Colbert Report has been on, I think, for 10.
And
yeah, exactly. I thought the same thing. And he leaves that last year, leaving that spot open. And then Jon Stewart announces he's going to be retiring from The Daily Show.
The timing of all of this worse for Comedy Central. You lost your number three, your number two, and your number one. And in that order, you lose number three. You're like, well, it's okay. I've got number two and number one. And then you lose number two, and you're like, ugh. And then you lose number one. If any of them had left in a different order, or if Letterman had held off, they would not have lost all three chips. They're three most prominent players. All due respect to everybody else on The Daily Show and their other shows and Larry Wilmore. You know, those were the most visible people, the guys that were, in play for Comedy Central. And now all three are gone. And if Stewart had announced first, either Oliver or Colbert would have taken over The Daily Show. I don't think there's any doubt about that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Or the Colbert Report would just kind of replace The Daily Show.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows what would, and something new would take it there. Yeah. So it was just, it's just an awful, awful, dominoes falling in just the right order to screw up Comedy Central. They must be beside themselves. If Stewart had said 15 years is enough, they'd be okay. They're not the only people who are sad. Booksellers are very sad. That was a constant theme. You know, Jon Stewart doesn't sell tons of copies for books, but he does get books' attention and nonfiction books and serious works of politics and social media. He was a godsend to the book industry. They loved him, outside of Oprah, who is a universe unto herself in terms of selling books. Jon Stewart was one of the best and most visible platforms they had, not just to sell the hard types of books that they're selling, but to reach a young audience. So he was just everything and a bag of chips as far as they were concerned.
I would imagine Fresh Air, which is on NPR, maybe less so, but also falls into that category.
No, absolutely. Fresh NPR and Fresh Air. I don't even know if Fresh Air is an NPR show.
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah, because you can get confused by that because they're not all NPR.
Right, I think it's like PRI.
Fresh Air. Yeah, there's PRI and NPR and a lot of other ones. They're not all the same. But Fresh Air is one on public radio stations that certainly is great for selling books. And NPR and public radio is great for music. You know, there's lots of outlets that cover stuff. But believe me, if all of NPR disappeared, it wouldn't disappear one day. Jon Stewart is one big visible platform, and to have it go away really hurts them.
Well, I mean, so what do you think of this? Enough has been said about, Jon Stewart's impact on the media. We don't need to go over that. Look,
no.
Okay, maybe we do, but...
No, we don't.
Okay. But, I mean, what do you personally think of him leaving? I my thought immediately was, well, what else is he going to do? I mean,
and
yes.
And my thought was, run for president. Is he going to run in 2016 or 2024? And then I said, as soon as an hour later, NBC said they were suspending Brian Williams. And I tweeted, he can take over for Jon Stewart. I think he's free for 6 months.
That's true. And apparently, according to many reports, that's what Brian Williams really wanted to do anyway.
Yeah, no, that's not true, is it?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
But no, I mean, he said there was some reports going around that Brian Williams, the real news anchor, wanted to take over for Jay Leno. And that just kind of, and it was even mentioned during the Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary. Somebody kind of made a joke about it.
Well, there's, Comedy Central is part of Viacom, aren't they?
Comedy, yes, they are.
They are Viacom, right?
Yes.
So they've got a lot of turmoil because Van Toffler is leaving Viacom, and he's been in charge of MTV and VH1 and Logo and all those little channels, you know what I mean? He's leaving after 28 years. Take that, Jon Stewart, in your 17 years. You know, that's a long time in charge of programming that's supposed to reach kids. That's kind of an amazing run. And he argues he's leaving on a high note, that, you know, that MTV and VH1 and all the others are in good shape right now. They're doing great on social media. You know, the networks want the audience that they reach to be measured in new ways because they feel like Nielsen is missing a lot of the buzz and hype that they get. But he's leaving on great terms. The shows or networks are in decent shape. He's leaving, but he's still going to be involved in the VMAs and other stuff. He just wants to do new things. It's been 28 years, but it adds to the turmoil of Viacom. You know, you've got Comedy Central, you've got MTV, you know, everything seems to be up in the air.
Well, who would you replace Jon Stewart with? Do you have anybody off the top of your head?
I have no idea. Don't care.
You don't care. So what about Samantha Bee? Do you know who she is?
I, of course, know who she is. Yes. I have no idea who would be good in that job. She and her husband have been on the show. They could be co-anchors. If I was going to do that, I'd probably make them co-anchors. Ooh. You know, then suddenly you get to do the morning news. You get to mock a new area of news media. The chit-chat between the hosts and how they're all love each other and friends and talk about their day and bitch at each other. And ha, ha, ha. You know, at least that would give a fresh angle to the show.
What about Asif Manvi?
I'm not going to go through the whole cast. I don't give a damn who they put in place. They won't be nearly as good as the show. It doesn't matter. It'll be something new. They'll have to make it their own. Jon Stewart changed it from what Craig Kilborn did. It doesn't matter. They'll have to find somebody. They'll get tons of attention. We'll see what happens.
You know what's getting tons of attention right now? Actually,
no, what?
A couple things. One, House of Cards, which always seems to get a ton of attention whenever there's a new season, except this time there was a new season, which will start, I think, in a couple of weeks, except Netflix decided that for a lucky few people, they could get to see it, like, right now. They accidentally
posted it. Right. Now, what I haven't heard yet is any follow-up. Like, was it pirated? Did people see it and immediately grab every episode? Because that's what people do. If something gets leaked out accidentally, they grab it and copy it. And then they post it up everywhere. I haven't heard if that's actually happened. Have you?
No, not at all.
Right. But, so like, let's do some follow-up, people. Come on. You're like, okay, it was posted accidentally. Big deal. It happened, and they took it back down. It's worth a little blurb. But then you want to know, did anybody grab it? Is it on pirate lines? You know, it's easy enough to check, surely.
Well, but really, the show getting the most attention these days is this little show called Empire, which started out pretty good. I mean—
That is literally my That makes my skin crawl every time people do that. A tiny little band called the Beatles. It's like, it just drives me nuts.
Okay. Well, it really this does. Gigantic, enormous.
It's a top 10 show. It's a popular hit show. Why do you have to say a little singer called Barbara Streisand?
It's irony.
It just drives me nuts.
Well, this show started out with good ratings, and it's gotten better every single week.
It started out with great ratings.
5 weeks in a row, the ratings have improved. And now I think it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because we're all talking about it. So people say, I better watch this show Empire everybody's talking about.
Well, that's exactly how it works. You go to the water cooler and say, did you see Empire this week? Oh, it's really great. That's called word of mouth.
Well, first of all, where is my water cooler? I have not seen or found my water cooler.
I have a Poland Spring right next to me. Yeah, 5 weeks in a row of ratings of growth in overnight ratings. That is tremendous. I don't know if that's ever happened before. It can't grow that much more. You know, it grew like by a couple hundred thousand this week. It's got to slow down at some point. It won't be a big deal. But wow, that's crazy. So we got a couple pointers for Empire, things they might want to keep in mind. Don't do any fan-generated social media campaigns. You know, we say, hey, guys, post, you know, put your favorite captions to these pictures and stills from Empire. Don't do that. Don't have Terrence Howard do any interviews unless it's a I was a bad person. I've learned my lesson interview. And he's seated next to his wife.
Now, you must be referring to the allegations.
Not allegations. He's got criminal record. Things have been brought forward. Restraining orders by wives. Charges. He's pled guilty to lesser charges. No, it's actual multiple wives and girlfriends. It's not pleasant. It's very sad. But thank God we're in a world where, hey, guess what? If you've got a record of physical abuse against women, suddenly people are paying attention and they don't like it. Well, that's not such a bad thing, is it?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, you know what? I'm just going to make a note here. File restraining order against Terrence Howard just in case. Okay, now I know. I just added that to my to-do list.
Yeah. So, but luckily for Terrence Howard, Emil Hirsch managed to steal the spotlight in that particular category. I mean, good God.
Yeah. You know, he was up at Sundance and I guess he kind of got into a tussle with a studio executive.
No, he didn't get in a tussle. A tussle is two people going at it. He attacked a woman. He attacked this female executive unprovoked for no reason whatsoever, according to every report I've seen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, no. He just went up to her and was like, oh, you look too nice to be here, too wealthy. What are you doing here? This is Sundance. This is for cool people. And she was like, get away from me. And like he left with his friends and then came back and attacked her from behind, threw her on the ground. He was choking her. People had to grab him off her. I mean, she doesn't know him from Adam, from what I've read. And he's now gone into rehab, of course, as one will. And his lawyer says he has no idea what happened. It's to make sure it never happens again. He's going into rehab. One has to roll their eyes, sadly, at somebody going into rehab these days, because it seems like the first pro forma step in trying to squelch, you know, issues around bad behavior.
I was surprised Brian Williams didn't say, I'm taking 6 months off. I'm going to be in rehab.
Yeah, really? So God willing, if Emil Hirsch has issues, it'll be dealt with and taken care of because clearly he needs help. I don't know what happened, but bizarre, sad, upsetting story.
He
but
was Terrence in 10,000 Saints, the movie that premiered up there. And when you first see him on screen, you just have to think, wow, put the chalupa down. No more tacos for you.
Maybe that's the character.
Gained a lot of weight. No. No, I saw the
film. He looked fine in Fury, didn't he?
Fury, yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, no. I mean, is there any reason not to assume it wasn't just for the role?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you. He looked definitely a changed person.
I'm sorry, he's not in Fury.
I was going to say, I don't remember him in Fury, so I guess he didn't make that big of an impression.
I thought every young male star was in Fury.
I was asked, but I said, look, Brad and I, we don't get along ever since he stole Angie from me.
Well, he was in Bonnie and Clyde, the TV miniseries. That was back in 2013. He didn't look big then, and Lone Survivor was his last big hit, that war film. And he has two movies in the box, in the can, Just Jim and Vincent and Roxy. So, you know, we'll have to see. God willing, he'll pay whatever price he needs to pay for attacking this woman, apparently. And if he needs help, he'll get it.
Yeah, well, and hopefully we'll look back on this and it won't be that, you know, won't be a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal for her, but I know what you're doing. You're trying to get us to Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. I was trying to do that. Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, it's almost, you read this story and you think, what? The William Morris Endeavor Agency is finding religion. That's right. It's signed megachurch Hillsong, known for its flashy concert-like services and celebrity attendees like Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez. Hillsong reaches 100,000 people in 11 countries with its weekly services. That's a pittance, but their real power is in Christian music, videos, and as a brand. Hillsong joins the roster of WME alongside prosperity gospel proponent Joel Osteen.
Joel Osteen, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it Osteen?
Osteen.
I don't know if I've actually heard his name pronounced. All I know is that he believes Jesus wants you to be filthy rich.
He does?
That's what Joel says.
I'm beginning to like this Jesus guy. Well, also T.D. Jakes is there at WME and more. WME also suddenly discovered YouTube, apparently, signing a clutch of stars born on that outlet like Lohanthony and comic Bart Baker. Both creators of jokey videos. Weird Al Yankovic, you've got a lot to answer for. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop.
Oh.
You know, Hillsong has reach in the Christian market. It's reasonable. It is the first church, I think, to sign up to a talent agency. So that's very interesting. But they barely seem removed from a brand, you know, luxury brand, lifestyle brand. So it makes sense.
You know, I'm pretty sure right now you have somebody saying, God doesn't need an agent.
That's true.
In a long overdue move, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America has finally opened its doors to self-published authors. Good idea, since self-published authors are often focused on genres like sci-fi and fantasy. But the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, which has been around since 1965, and the voters of the Nebula Award, they're not just being nice. They need more members, as sci-fi and fantasy are in the doldrums. Sales have plummeted among major publishers, with fantasy particularly dead right now. Big houses simply aren't signing up writers. And ignoring a best-selling name like Hugh Howie, who made his bones as a self-published author, is just kind of dumb. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, I'm shocked that they hadn't invited them in beforehand. I mean, you got to set up some standards. Just because you post a single book online doesn't mean you should get to join. But, you know, if you generate a certain amount of income or sign with a publisher, or I don't know what metric you use, but I'm surprised they didn't do this a long time ago, since they're sci-fi people. They're supposed to love the internet.
That's true.
It's not supposed to be. But I'm a little surprised as well by the stories about sci-fi and fantasy being in such sales doldrums. You know, we're in the age of Game of Dragons, the Song of Ice and Fire series, and I did not
Game
know.
Game of Dragons? Don't you mean Game of Thrones?
Game of Thrones, I beg your pardon. I just did not know that they were suffering that much. I'm not sure if it's just compared to like a year or two ago when Harry Potter and Game of Thrones were doing so well, or whether it's a long systemic slump, but I did not know that. I'm trying to look up more solid info about what kind of drop and how long term and what it means. But when they say big houses simply aren't signing up sci-fi and fantasy writers, that makes you a little concerned.
The most visible platform for documentary films on TV is probably PBS. They, of course, work hand in hand with Ken Burns and deliver American Masters and other shows. But crucial to the world of independent documentary filmmakers are the two TV programs, POV and Independent Lens. An outcry arose when New York City's flagship station, WNET, probably the most important public station, PBS station in the country, and the home of those shows, by the way, said they were planning to move the show's time slot from Monday nights in primetime to Sunday nights at 11 p.m., you know, when everybody watches. On the far less visible channel, by the way, they're moving it to Channel 13 in New York.
Actually, I'm sorry, my mistake. It's Channel 21, WLIW. WNET is Channel 13.
Yeah, it's funny because when I read that originally, I thought, well, Channel 13 is kind of a big deal, no pun intended, in the PBS world. Now, unless you live in New York City, why would you really care about this? If the show is downgraded in New York City, many other PBS stations actually might follow suit. That's the problem. And if those donating money to documentary films like foundations and the like realize the end result won't have the plum airing on TV always guaranteed in the past, they might become less likely to fund vital work in the future. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal, I think. You know, you talk about the films that get made, the documentary films, this programming change could affect documentary filmmaking literally all over the world. You know, with the decline of local newspapers and media in general being more and more conglomerated into big multinationals, independent voices and journalists actually doing in-depth reporting on issues is becoming a scarcer and scarcer resource. And that's what they're not all hard-hitting journalistic exposés, but that's what these films do. They shine a light on issues and subjects and people that others aren't paying attention to. So to see that be threatened by this is really scary. On the other hand, I am empathetic. You know, it airs after Antiques Roadshow, and its numbers have been dropping a lot in recent years. And when you've got one of your biggest hits followed by a show that cannot hold on to it and is not bringing in an audience, you're wasting that time slot. So they need to figure out a way to keep the show visible without, you know, wasting the time slot following Antiques Roadshow. I don't know what that is, but putting it to 21 on 11 at night on Sunday is not the answer.
I guess my question is, does it matter when it airs? Because let's face it, we all watch television on time shifted these days. So who cares?
That's true. It should matter less and less. But you know, they need to do a better presence online and convince people that, no, we're reaching as many people. You know, again, that's all about Nielsen measurements and how you show what audience you're reaching and how. And if they can show, hey, POV and these shows are reaching people with our platform online, with the visibility, with the airing on multiple channels, it's accessible all the time on our website, et cetera, they can make that case, but they need to start making it.
This counts for good news in the book industry, by the way.
What's that?
The major UK bookstore chain Waterstones lost money last year. That's
well
actually
done.
Good news. Yes.
Well done.
Yes, but not so much as the year before. That's why it's good news, you see.
I have good news in the podcast world. We lost money this year.
Right. Well, they lost 18.6 million pounds, to which
I wish I'd lost 20 pounds.
I was going to
anyway.
Say, I just want to lose 4 pounds, please. Just 4 pounds. But the year before that, I guess Waterstones lost 26 million pounds. So things are moving in the right direction, and managing director James Daunt is optimistic they'll soon edge into profitability. But look closer, and the numbers are more depressing. Sales are still falling overall. The one area of growth? Non-book items, which surged 30%. Sales of Kindles, a partner with Waterstones, were quote-unquote massively down per Daunt, but they'll keep them in stores as a symbolic sign of importance.
Massively down.
Massively down. We're going to keep them in
that's
stores.
From the company.
As a symbolic sign of the technology that's killing us. They're at sixes and sevens when it comes to selling ebooks at all, and this is a quote, "We do not sell ebooks in a meaningful, sensible manner," said Daunt. And finally, one last number. Number of employees are also down as they've laid off another 500 people. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal in the sense of what a poorly reported story. They're like, oh, this is great news. Literally, you had to look into the story and parse the numbers for us to present the story we have, which is actually, no, it's terrible news. They're not selling books. They can't sell ebooks. They're firing employees, and the only area where they're making money is, you know, stationery and diaries and other non-book stuff. So, yes, Waterstones bookstore will survive as long as it doesn't sell any books.
Hold on. I'm just making a note to go to Waterstones to get new diary. It's right after the Terrence Howard restraining order now. Now, I'm sitting here and our tweet about HBO locking down John Oliver for two more seasons of Last Week Tonight just came through, and it's being favorited a number of times and retweeted. So it looks like John Oliver is not going back to Comedy Central.
Certainly not. That would be crazy.
But
he's developed his own style, his own thing. He's doing it. You know, it's very hard to create a vibe. And you know what? Doing it once a week is hard. He's probably going, thank God I don't have to do this every day.
Netflix? In Cuba? See! Okay, it's bad enough when we butcher French and Mandarin, but we promise not to tackle Spanish either. But it is big news, or is that gigante? Get it?
gigante.
Yeah. Well, that it's big news that Netflix is available in Cuba, although mostly ceremonial, or not ceremonial. What's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
Okay, I can't find it. Well, about one out of four Cubans has access to the internet, though there's also a series of closed webs people use to communicate with one another and do basic online things like email, but no politicking or the government would shut them down. This shadow web is not included in those stats, nor perhaps could they handle streaming video. No word yet on what restrictions Cuba insisted on in terms of programming Netflix could and could not make available. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, or is it not ceremonial? I keep going back to that word. What is the word I'm looking for, darn it?
Symbolic?
Thank you. Thank you. Symbolic is the word I was looking for. You see, you did know the word. You were holding out on me.
I don't think we know enough information. I'm sure Cuba did not say, show whatever you want. So what did they agree to? And, you know, what you agree to when you want to have a market share in China or Cuba or, you know, the UAE, that matters to me as far as whether what they're doing is smart or good or ethical and whether it's good for their brand overall. So until I know more about what they agreed to, because I'm sure Cuba didn't say, come on in, big American company, I'm withholding judgment.
Well, and I'm sure Cuba said, sure, come on in, big American company. You can get all these customers who don't have credit cards to sign up for your service. There are very few people with credit cards in Cuba. So that's why this was seen mostly as a symbolic move on Netflix's part, as a way for, you know,
we got our thing in one more country,
right? And it's, you know, Cuba's opening up, and look, we're doing business there now. So,
and they're going to be getting credit cards.
Yeah, that's the idea. Now, Darren Criss of Glee is taking over the lead role in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is now on Broadway. He's going to be doing that in late April, and not a moment too soon for all involved. John Cameron Mitchell is currently tackling the role he created, and while one should expect lines out the door, his seemingly unimprovable performance is now a show that tourists see as a star vehicle. Mitchell is doing very good business, and it's presumably cheap to run week to week, but he's not pulling in like Neil Patrick Harris numbers. For Criss, the opportunity to return to Broadway, where he attracted hordes for a brief stint in How to Succeed in Business, or is it just How to Succeed these days? I don't know. Well, it's welcome news either way. Criss stars in Glee, and rarely has a red-hot show, and that is Glee, fallen so far so fast. Recent episodes in its final brief season are doing CW-like numbers and ranking in the 90s and 100s. After being a top 20 show with DVDs and concert tours, a feature film, and tons of singles and album sales, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but yeah, it is. It's good for him. I just was shocked at how poorly Glee was doing. I mean, it just, when you look at the new episode, it's literally, I'm not shocked because it's a really bad show now. You know, it's just ridiculous. They keep returning to high school. They're just the biggest losers in the world. But it's like, it's ranked 101, I think, 2 weeks ago. It's just, it's unbelievable. I don't think I've ever seen any big, big show go that low before it got off the air. I mean, it's really sad. But, you know,
I think people got burned out on it. They just like kind of saturated the market with Glee, and people were like, okay, we're done with that now.
Well, there's a lot of creative mistakes, but anyway, that's not important. But Broadway is really star-driven. I mean, you look at, it's only a play. The people on that show must really be kind of miffed. That show stars Stocker Channing, F. Murray Abraham, Matthew Broderick. It's a host of famous people, but the second Nathan Lane stepped out, the box office really, really slumped. And, you know, and it's just got to be like, oh, excuse me, I'm Oscar winner F. Murray Abraham. I'm Matthew Broderick. I was in The Producers. You know, I'm Stocker Channing. I was on The West Wing. And yet the audience really fell for that show after Nathan Lane. I was kind of surprised, but that's what happens.
Well, I guess if you're on that show, you would consider it a big deal.
You mean Hedwig?
Well, no, it's only a play.
Oh, yeah, it's a big deal, unfortunately, for them, yeah.
I don't know why people don't want to see John Cameron Mitchell, the person, the actor.
I thought he would do better. I mean, he's doing good numbers. He's making money. People are there. It's, you know, pretty full houses. It's not like the house is empty or box office slumped. That's not the case at all. But if you look, wow, he's a, Darren Criss is, of course, the front page of BroadwayWorld.com. But if you look at the stats, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, as I scroll down, it's, you know, it's did 630,000 this week. I'm sure that the show is pretty cheap to run because it's just a band on stage and the set doesn't really move much. So it's a pretty cheap show to operate. It's more like a play, I think, than a musical.
Right.
And look, 80% of the tickets were sold and they did 83% of their grosses. Those are very good numbers. They could run a long time with him doing that. But it's not, you know, the event that I might have thought it would be, where people would clamor to see him again in a role that he made, you know, he created and made famous and owns forever. So I'm a little surprised.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And I wonder if you'll be a little surprised about the news we're going to cover in Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they will affect you. And everybody's talking this week about Spider-Man. And why? Because Sony is kind of leasing him back to Marvel and Disney.
Not leasing. You're echoing a journalist report, and leasing is not the word. They're loaning.
Yeah.
Hey, take them.
Yeah.
have fun. This is amazing. It's a cooperation between two studios with their franchises crossing over to each other. Has this ever happened before? I can't think of any example in the history of Hollywood that works like this. I mean, networks have done in-network.
Actually, I can think of at least one.
Ooh, cool. What?
Who Framed Roger Rabbit featured some of the Looney Tunes characters from Warner Brothers in what was, a Disney
excellent,
film.
Excellent example.
Yes.
And it was incredibly hard to do, and that's probably the reason they didn't do a sequel.
Well, yes.
Because everybody said, you made a lot of money with that. If you want Bugs, I mean, if you want our, and they weren't, like, it wasn't like Bugs Bunny, was it?
I think it was like,
was Bugs in it? I mean, Porky Pig was in it. I don't remember who else, but it was big. It was big characters, but still, it was very, very difficult to pull off. It took a lot of sweet talk and convincing them, and they made it happen. But that's a great example. Yeah, so it has happened before, but that's how rare it is. You know, on TV, we have crossover episodes between inside a network in different shows. I think there's probably been crossover between different networks once or twice, but not very much.
Because now, there's some crossover
in the game. Why do it?
Well, and apparently there's some crossover, not that this is the story we're talking about, but between Backstrom and Bones, from what I understand. Have you seen this show, Backstrom?
Are they different networks or the same?
I think they're the same network, but have you
that happens all the time. Law and Order, 3, you know, that's not unusual.
Have you seen the show, Backstrom?
No, life is short. It won't last.
You don't think? I mean, Rain Johnson is unbelievable.
I know it's going to be canceled. It will not last. It's doing terrible.
Ugh. Okay, well, that's it. I'm not watching any more shows until I know they're on for 5 years.
Well, you know, if you're enjoying it, you can enjoy it. Is it a long, big arc show, or can you just enjoy individual episodes?
I think you can enjoy individual episodes.
Well, there you go. So, yeah, so let's explain what's happening.
You know what I didn't enjoy? The individual episodes of Spider-Man, the last two.
You did? I didn't.
I said I didn't enjoy them.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, I agree. That was the problem. Spider-Man is was purchased by Sony from Marvel. When Marvel was in the doldrums and couldn't get anything, Sony said, we'll give you like $20 million and a piece of whatever to let us make Spider-Man movies. And they said, God bless you. Thank you. And they made the Tobey Maguire films with Sam Raimi, made that a huge property, massive critical and commercial acclaim, and everybody's happy. Then Disney bought Marvel, and now they, of course, have the Avengers and Thor and Captain America, and they have all these big stars crossing over to each other. Meanwhile, Spider-Man is in the doldrums thanks to the last two movies with Andrew Garfield. They did okay, but they didn't do great, and they didn't do near what the first Spider-Man movies did.
No, they tried to, as they said, I think this was the first time the word reboot was used for a franchise.
What are you talking about? No, it wasn't.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong about that then. Maybe it was with Who Framed Roger Rabbit. They tried to...
Yeah, I mean, reboot is not a new word.
Well, okay, I'm not saying that it was a new word. I'm saying...
You said it was the first time it was used for a movie. No.
Okay.
That's...
All right. Well, I guess another example of a reboot. And somebody called it the emo Spider-Man. I don't know who, but...
But it was stupid because it was literally the same... Like, he was already too old for the role when they cast him. You know, Andrew Garfield's a terrific actor, but like, we just had Tobey Maguire. They redid the same exact damn story with another actor who's just as old, if not older looking. You know, it was completely pointless creatively. It was just stupid.
Well, artistically and creatively is one thing, and monetarily, they both didn't do so well. I mean,
yeah, they did fine. They did fine, but they didn't bring in a lot of money. They weren't billion-dollar franchises, and that was the potential that they saw. Meanwhile, Disney's raking in the dough with the Avengers and all their superhero movies. But you thought never the twain will meet. Why is Sony going to want to loan out Spidey to Marvel? And if they do, they're going to say, we want $50 million and a cut of the gross.
Yeah. Well, and so instead they said, hey, look, borrow Spidey for one of your Avengers movies or one of your what are called now, as I see, multi-character universe movies. And it'll give, you know, Spidey some, it'll increase his Q rating. It'll give him some exposure to younger audiences and to audiences that might not be seeing Spidey in other ways. We need people to see this guy. Get him out there. He's our contract player, but, you know, we want him to star in your movie, you know, once. And then maybe...
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that studios would loan out actors. I don't know if they would ever loan out characters, but major studios, I don't know if actors ever crossed over. But you'd see, like, oh, you know, like they wouldn't give Shirley Temple to MGM for The Wizard of Oz, for example. That sort of crossover... But they would sometimes punish an actor by handing them over to another studio and say, hey, you make a picture for them. I don't know if a character ever crossed over. I'm sure some film historian will be able to tell us, but I'll keep looking into that. But yeah, so what happened here? They said, we want Spidey to be cool again. So they're both going to cast the new Spider-Man together, I think is what the feeling is, right?
Yes, exactly.
That's kind of crazy. So like, can you imagine being
they're
at that
rebooting
audition?
They're rebooting the reboot.
That's right. And can you imagine being young actors at that audition? You've got everybody from Disney, everybody from Marvel, everybody from Sony. I mean, you've got Stan Lee in the corner, and they're all watching you try to do a scene as Spider-Man. Pressure is always big, but that's got to be off the charts. And everybody's going to have an opinion. How are they ever going to agree on who should be Spider-Man? That alone seems daunting.
Well, I love this sentence from the LA Times article. They say, Marvel and Sony are exploring ways of possibly integrating characters from the MCU into future Spider-Man films.
Ooh.
Now, MCU, Marvel comic book universe, multi-character universe? I don't know what it is, but I love this, like, MCU as if, like, now it's like...
We all know what it means.
Yeah, CSI.
Surely they defined it before they used it that way.
I would have to go back and check, but I just thought, oh, great, now we've got yet another acronym to worry about.
So they're giving him free, like, let's cast in Spider-Man, we're going to make him actually young again, more like Logan Lerman than, you know, some 30-year-old guy pretending to be in high school. He's going to appear in a Captain America film, and that makes sense because they're building up to this big storyline in the comic books that involves Spider-Man. And if they're going to do that storyline across multiple Avenger movies, they need Spidey, or they got to dramatically rework the whole dynamics of the story and what they do with it. So they really wanted Spider-Man, and Sony needs Spider-Man to be cool again. And what better way than to be in a billion-dollar movie or a big hit movie, at least? So they loan out Spidey. They have Spidey in a cool movie. He comes back to Sony. They do their own movie. Maybe Avengers loans them some of their characters for crossovers into Spidey. Everybody's happy. But still, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I guess there was some discussion about whether Sony would just sell Spider-Man back to Marvel.
Why the hell would you do that?
And, well, because Marvel actually retains the merchandising rights. So Sony does not actually earn any money from all that merchandising.
Right. They just make $700 million off a movie if it doesn't do well.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
There was some talk about it because, you know, they needed some cash. You know, they haven't been doing well.
They need cash, really? Loan them a few bucks.
I think they may need a little bit more. Do you have another 10?
Yeah, I got a 10.
Okay. But, you know, they're trying to keep Spidey alive.
So Spider-Man is dead. Long live Spider-Man.
Wait, what? Oh, I see. You're moving us into obituaries.
That's right.
So this week, who isn't with us any longer?
Louis Jourdan.
Ah, from
French actor. Oh, Gigi is about to open on Broadway, which I'm not looking forward to because I don't like the movie. But Louis Jourdan starred in it. He also played the villain in Octopussy. He was a member of the French Resistance. That's probably his greatest role. He starred on Broadway in a show with James Dean in a minor role. You know, that was one of James Dean's early breaks where he got attention. And this is bizarre. He was in the out-of-town tryouts for the flop musical On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever. Now, Louis Jourdan for Hollywood for 20 years or so was like, you need a French guy and you can't get Maurice Chevalier, get Louis Jourdan. You know, he was just your urbane European. That was who you got. And he was in On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever, and they replaced him with John Cullum. I mean, talk about going in a different direction. You just can't be upset if you're Louis Jourdan and you're replaced by John Cullum. That's bizarre. And his greatest film by far is Letter from an Unknown Woman. If you've never seen it, the Max Ophuls film, it's a masterpiece. Check it out. His worst film may be Year of the Comet, which is one of the first films I saw when I moved to New York as a, you know, journalist and a freelancer. I got a free screening to Year of the Comet. I took my roommate at the time, Ron, as the movie was unspooling, this film by Peter Yates in which Louis Jourdan played a bad guy. I literally took a dollar out of my pocket and handed it to him as recompense for wasting his time. I'm like, here's a buck. I'm sorry I made you sit here. Please take this gratuity. I apologize.
And it was a dollar, which should tell you how much movie tickets were and why I always ask that we adjust numbers for inflation.
Well, it was a free screening, so we didn't pay money to see it.
Well,
it was symbolic, really. But so he's gone. Ed Sable, the founder of NFL Films, died. He was 98 years old. Yeah, I mean, and he really an influential guy. Their documentary films about football and the NFL really influenced everybody. I mean, that really changed the face of documentaries for sports and what was possible and what would it strive for. And you can see his influence all over the place through all the networks and on cable, of course, and ESPN.
Plus, wasn't it his voice as well?
That I don't know. But the voiceover artist Gary Owens also died. He was the announcer of Laugh-In, and he died at 80. And if you've ever seen a clip of Laugh-In, you probably recognize him. He had long, shaggy hair, had one hand cupped over his ear, and that was what I thought all voiceover people did, because that's the way Gary Owens did it. And he did the narration for Laugh-In. He did voiceovers on cartoons like Space Ghost, thousands of commercials. So, you know, he was a fixture, but clearly Laugh-In is what he'll be remembered for.
You know what we're going to be remembered for?
What?
Being chosen to replace Brian Williams on NBC News.
Well, that'd be exciting. They'd be going in a new direction. But there's one final person. This is the one that really interests me. The one who died is Leslie Gore. She died of lung cancer at 68. She, of course, sang It's My Party and You Don't Own Me.
Okay.
And she was a teen idol star. Quincy Jones discovered her and produced her early records. She kept going to college when her career was at its peak. She went to Sarah Lawrence. She was a kid in high school. And even as she graduated high school, she went to college. She's like, well, you know, pop music is very fickle, she would tell journalists. It'd be silly to just, you know, quit my education. So she went to school while she was there. And then she had a second career as a songwriter because she didn't write those songs. And she became famous for writing Out Here on My Own, which was an Oscar-nominated song from Fame. And then in 2005, she came out, like 30, 40 years, even though her story was sort of told in what was that movie called? Beat of My Heart. Oh my God.
Don't ask me. I barely know the word symbolic.
There was a movie about the Brill Building days. And there was a storyline with Bridget Fonda in which she played a closeted lesbian, a young teen idol who realized she was a lesbian. That wasn't really quite the story for Leslie Gore, because she really didn't know she was gay when she was a kid. She didn't know until she went to Sarah Lawrence. So she didn't have that sort of tragic closeted life story that you saw in the film Grace of My Heart, directed by Allison Anders, who's a really terrific director who fell off the map, by the way. But, you know, that story was told in that movie, and she finally came out in 2005. And look how far she's come. As a kid, she didn't even imagine she might be gay because it just wasn't even mentioned or thought about in her world. She had no role models to look at. And then she finally came out late in her life, and the New York Times publishes her obituary, and they just say very casually that the information came from Lois Sassoon, her partner of 33 years. You know, something that would have never been mentioned. They might have said a longtime friend, you know, or her buddy. And, but today, the world has changed so much since she was a kid and sang It's My Party that that's how she's remembered in the New York Times. I interviewed her once when she had an album coming out called Ever Since, which is quite good. She was born on my birthday. So rest in peace, Leslie Gore.
Wow, you're really into Leslie Gore.
Well, sure.
Well, I hope our audience and our listeners are into our show. In fact, they can write to us and let us know. They can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com to give us their feedback and their comments, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, any kind of podcast app that you have on your mobile phone. We should be there. So please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us and ways to subscribe to us and ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our username. You can also like us on Facebook, where our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Again, we have a website, showbizsandbox.com is the website that you can find us on. But sometimes you can find Michael on one of his various websites. Michael, what is it this week?
My website is Darren Criss is so much cooler than glee.com.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, if you can't find some of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there, try the Huffington Post, or you can go to michaelgiltz.com, or head on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my writing and work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.